It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about suffering states and petulant properties. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of Mitchell Anthony Herron and Shane H. Sellers are voiceover talents Kevin Barberi and Jonathan West. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by Mitchell Anthony Herron and performed by Kevin Barberi. In it, we meet a man who is drawn to ease his constant suffering of tooth pain by removing them by any means necessary. Now, without further ado, I present to you Lost False Teeth.
Murray has a difficult time concentrating with that low humming sound. The sudden shift of the air conditioner coming on in the dead of summer perks up his hearing. The lights bother his vision. Fluorescent lights have always had this effect on him. Lately, though, the piercing glare has been amplified. A dull, throbbing pain made its presence known in the very back of his molars. He desperately wanted to chew on a carrot. Sometimes, this helped settle the problem. The pain had become a constant in Murray's day. It didn't matter what medication he took for it. The pain in his teeth grew day by day. It was never the same tooth twice. He thought it could be the gums, but he wasn't 100% sure. They certainly bleed when he brushes them. It burned when he would swish around his antiseptic mouthwash. It had to be gingivitis. His fear of dentists, though, prevented him from really finding out the answer. Murray could fix this himself. He didn't need any dentists. He could just treat it with oral pain gel every 45 minutes for the next several days. It would be fine, just fine. But he wasn't fine. The pain might be a regular occurrence and something that he has come to expect from his day-to-day life. He knew how to live with it. At least he thought he knew. Today marked a day that pushed him over the limit in his pain tolerance. The day was not unlike any other day. The sun came up in the east. The roads were packed with vehicles all rushing to their jobs or schools. They pay no mind to anything outside of their own life view. Murray would open the store, keys and coffee in hand. In the delicate balancing act, coffee would spill, and it took everything to provide the complete loss of morning rejuvenation. The morning festivities go on as expected, point by point, beat by beat. The paperwork gets filled out. The register gets set up, and everything gets ready for the day's opening. The two tobacco cabinets are unlocked. Murray just waits for the clock to reach the required time. He opens the door, and an older man, visibly in his 80s, is escorted inside by two younger men in their 20s. They look like his grandchildren. They immediately turn their attention to Murray. "Excuse me, sir, but By chance, have you found any false teeth or dentures? He seems to have lost them when he was here last night. Murray wasn't there the night before, but he would be happy to look for them. He checks the lockboxes attached to the register. No sign of any false teeth. Murray promises to look in the office. The two men escort their grandfather around the relatively small store. It was early in the morning, so the customers were nil. It was quiet, as Murray preferred not to have the radio on. Terrestrial radio has been a wasteland for more than 20 years. No sense subjecting oneself to that. Murray checks in the office, but nothing is there. The office looks the same as it does every day. Papers are not in order, but they're there. The chair is missing a wheel, making scuff marks on the floor. How does someone misplace their teeth? This man needed assistance to make his way through the store. When did he happen to come in here the night before? The note takes him back to the pain in his own teeth. The pain was inching its way to the forefront of his mind. It was dull at first, dull but constant, pounding rhythmically like a drum. You can time it with a metronome. Each tick of the clock carries with it a burst of pain. The oral gel isn't doing anything. Now he's just eating it. There couldn't possibly be any nutritional value to eating oral gel. There needs to be a better way. The pain is finding a way to turn Murray's stomach. It brings forth a bout of nausea so intense that Murray is forced to race into the restroom. He flings open the heavy door and takes two big thudding steps to enter the restroom with the out-of-order sign on it. He quickly locks it behind him before expunging the contents of his stomach, a mix of his oatmeal breakfast and oral gel, into the porcelain bowl. He feels a sharp pain in his stomach. He drops to his knees, clutching his stomach when he passes out from the pain. The combination was simply too much. He can no longer hear the cries outside or the extreme knocking. Eventually, all that goes away. He wakes to see a blurry outline of a toilet, the base having not been cleaned in quite some time. He looks up to see the painting hanging on the wall, a frail blue flower blowing in the wind, hanging on to life by a thread. Murray knows what that can be like. He spits onto the ground, and in that wad of saliva, mucus, and blood lie a perfectly preserved tooth, complete with roots and all. Murray pushes himself into a sitting position and uses the tip of his index finger to push the tooth around. A piece of paper is slipped underneath the door, and it stops directly behind Murray. It simply reads, "Lost false teeth," and a phone number directly underneath that. Murray doesn't understand what that means. He just knows the pain in his teeth and in his gums has come back with a vengeance. Murray pushes his index finger into his gums. He is hoping for some relief, but none comes, only a little more blood. He uses his index and thumb to wiggle the tooth directly next to the open space. The pain has begun to blind him, making his vision bleary from the tears forming. The tooth is certainly loose, but stubbornly won't come out. That is what will cease the pain, a form of transference that has to be the cure to ease the ills of his troubled body. He wiggles it back and forth and front to back. No luck. He starts to twist it, ripping and tearing the flesh of his gums with each turn. Blood starts to trickle out the corner of his mouth. He quickly wipes it away with the back of his hand and goes after another tooth. This one was stubborn and wanted to remain firmly snug in its home spot. He tries to grip the tooth, but the saliva and blood make it too slippery to grasp properly. The pain is back with a vengeance now. Murray reaches into his pocket to pull out the oral gel. The pain is making his joints ache and weak. He has a hard time holding on to the oral gel. He bumps into it, and it skids across the floor and hits the wall directly underneath the damaged and dangling toilet paper rolls. It lay in between two squares of paper, crumpled up into an arch shape. If you look at them in just the right light, the pieces of arched toilet paper have a special glow about them. They rest upon the floor, and they are clean and unused. Murray only wanted the gel. He reaches for it, and it rolls along behind the toilet. Back there was a grimy mess. It hadn't been cleaned in weeks. The pain was getting worse. Murray is becoming desperate. He lies down on his stomach and reaches his hand towards the back of the toilet. He can't see anything. His face is pressed against the filthy porcelain bottom. He is scratching and clawing at the back, trying to grab a hold of the gel. The pain is throbbing now in sync with his heartbeat, increasing with his desperation. His fingertips touch the sharp ending of the oral gel container. He screams out before finally grabbing a hold of the gel. He pulls back into a seated position and squirts the remaining contents of the gel into his mouth. He rubs his gritty fingers along his teeth, hoping for the sudden rush of relief. None came. The gel doesn't work anymore. He had developed a tolerance for it. It was nothing more than a disgusting meal for his upset stomach. He lies down on his back, staring up at the ceiling, and closes his eyes. He needed to rest. "Please, God, give me some rest," he thought. Would that rest come? Only for a short time. He slowly awakens as if emerging from an induced sleep of surgery. His eyes are open, but his vision is blurry. His eyes are focusing on the first thing he sees. It is a painting on the wall. He can only make out thin, light blue lines. They rise and crest like waves. The tops are seafoam green. It must be a painting of water. Murray sits up and remembers where he is. He had passed out on the floor of the restroom at his job. "Oh no," thinks Murray. "How long was he out for? Somebody needed to be tending to the register." He stands up quickly and he has to place his hand on the wall, feeling lightheaded. He needed to get out of here, but the pain in his teeth and his gums had not subsided. It had only increased in strength and frequency. He reaches for the doorknob to exit and finds it locked. This shouldn't be possible. These doors are designed to open even if locked. He looks down at the handle and realizes rather quickly that the knob has been reversed, the outside in and the inside out. A piece of paper slipped under the door. It reads, "Lost false teeth." He crumbles it and throws it against the wall. What does that mean? What does that have to do with the pain and being locked here? Murray reaches his index finger into his mouth and tries to squeeze a molar to reduce the pain. He knows to take the pressure somewhere else, and that might help. It doesn't, but it does seem to provide comfort when he adds his thumb and pulls on the tooth. As it rips and tears forth from the pink gums, his pain lessens and his euphoria increases. The tooth is proving a difficult one. His saliva makes the tooth slippery and he has to keep drying it off with brown paper towels. They're thin and don't suck up any moisture at all. He is using so much of it, and his attempts to toss them in the trash receptacle prove fruitless. They're just piling up on the floor. Murray has gotten winded. He supports himself by leaning on the sink. The pain comes back this time, even stronger. What is going on here? Is his body telling him that he needs to remove his teeth in order to feel relief? He balls up his feet and takes a few deep breaths. If he can't pull it out naturally, then maybe he can punch himself to the point where the tooth will fall out. He pulls the fist back and takes a few more deep breaths. He didn't know if he had the wherewithal or the sheer insanity to do this. He was just going to have to try. He punches himself as hard as he can directly in the spot of the loose molar. This causes him to step back in pain, almost running into the wall. This restroom was not big. He didn't have a lot to work with. He goes for a second punch. It hurts, but it doesn't seem to have an effect on the tooth. The pain in his knuckles and his cheekbone are nothing compared to the pain in the teeth. He can pretty much feel his blood pressure rising. He backs up into the painting on the wall, the blue brushstrokes trying to capture a lily in the sun. It carries with it no meaning in this dingy, brightly lit restroom. Why won't this pain stop? It seems to be traveling from tooth to tooth. How can he make it stop? The punching is useless. There was a shelving unit above the toilet. The only things on it were rolls of toilet paper, glass cleaner, and a box cutter. Why would there be a box cutter in here for just anybody to gain access to? Who cares about that as the pain emerges triumphant from the brief respite? Murray quickly grabs the box cutter. He holds the blade up to the light, trying to gather up the courage to do what must be done. This is the only way the pain can stop. The light was bright and overwhelming, and the blade on the box cutter was dull and rusty. This might not do what it needs to do. The surging sensation is back. He slaps his face again. He doesn't want to use the box cutter, but he must. Nothing is working anymore, and he can't find his way out of this place. He turns to face the door, pulling on the handle. It's locked and won't budge an inch. Murray cries out, hoping somebody would hear him. After several minutes, nothing has happened. Murray was alone in this restroom with his pain and the box cutter. No end in sight. He slumps down back against the door, gripping the cutter tightly. He could see the knuckles turn white and the blood recede. The pain is back. It feels like it is echoing off of his teeth and out into the world. Tooth pain has been linked to heart health in the past. It could be a signal that your heart is failing. Is that what this is? A heart attack? His pulse was racing immensely. His breathing was becoming more rapid, taking in too much oxygen or not enough. He really couldn't make heads or tails of it. He did know the room was spinning and the pain in his teeth was increasing. The pain was becoming the only thing he could think of, even though he was in danger of passing out again. He wasn't sure if his head could handle that again. He looks back to the box cutter he held in his hand. It had seen better days. The yellow plastic was fading and making more room for the brown invading its space. The bits of metal that you could see were thinly coated with rust. There was no way he could use this thing. But as the pain grows, the notion becomes a little less far-fetched. He places the tip of the blade against the gum line. He begins to press it in between the gums and the tooth. It started bleeding immediately, but he didn't care. It relieves the pain. He digs the rusty blade more into the gums to loosen the tooth. The pain would be gone if he removed the teeth. The teeth were the ultimate problem, and he had a solution for it finally. Remove the teeth. The room was spinning more and more as Murray was hacking and slashing away at his gums, and teeth were being forcibly removed. He would drop them on the floor as they hit with a tiny clank. It sounds like pennies falling, tinkling on the linoleum floor. He jams the butt of the box cutter into the base of a molar and runs face first into the wall. It loosens the tooth, allowing him to pluck it out of his mouth like picking a flower from the garden. It was precious, as it was the last one. All by its lonesome reflecting light on the parts not coated in blood and flecks of gum flesh. He drops the box cutter on the floor and kicks it. It lodges itself behind the toilet. He slumps down back against the wall in a seated position. His breaths were long and shallow at the same time. His heart had to be racing a million miles. The adrenaline was hiding the true pain Murray was bound to feel once he woke from this daze. The mania got to him. What had he done? He wants to close his eyes, but something is stopping him. Was it disbelief? He stares down at his last tooth. He is surrounded by blood, pieces of gum flesh, and teeth. Truly a tooth fairy's feast. Just then, he hears the door unlock. He wanted to rush towards it and run from this place, but he had no more energy. The door is pushed open slowly and something is slid in, stopping at Murray's feet. He gathers up the last little bit of energy he has left to pick up the thing that landed at his feet. He brings it up to his face to take a closer look. It was a pair of false teeth. He marvels at them and smiles a bit, revealing the damaged gums left behind by his butchery. He places them in his mouth, situating them to fit nicely, almost perfect as if they were made just for him. He rubs his tongue on the inside and outside of the teeth. He sits there, smiling and drooling a blood-saliva mixture onto his shirt, happy as can be.
I hope you enjoyed Lost False Teeth, as written by Mitchell Anthony Herron and performed by Kevin Barberi. Our second tale of the evening is written by Shane H. Sellers and is performed by Jonathan West. In it, a lawyer and a real estate broker devise a plan to steal a property. Only problem is, it seems the demo crew has found a coffin in the basement. And it's not empty. Now, without further ado, I present to you, A Dead Man Ate My Real Estate Broker.
When I was 8, my family took me to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. The air was filled with laughter and gentle chatter as families like mine stretched out on hot sand. The sun was hot and bright, the crash of the surf calming. I ran down to the water, sticking my hands deep into the cool, soft, wet sand until I could feel the hard shells of sand fiddlers. With a giant scoop, I lifted the small crabs out of their hiding spaces and retreated to my towel. I was curious about the small creatures, lifting the shells from their backs until I could see the orange and yellow insides. My attention soon shifted to a larger sand fiddler, perhaps the size of my palm. Using the sharp end of a seashell, I punctured its gray and white carapace and then sat it down. The sand fiddler ran back toward the water, the shell protruding from its back. I think back on my actions today, the blatant disregard for life, the pleasure and satisfaction it gave me to destroy something powerless in my hands. A child's folly, to be sure, but no one stopped me. Disturbing, I know, but I assure you I'm not some serial killer. As a woman, I grew to understand the value of life in all its forms. One winter in 2020, mice found their way into my garage. The cement floor soon became littered with rodent urine and droppings, prompting me to buy traps from Amazon. I couldn't help but notice how cheap the kill traps were compared to the live traps. As if the lives of the mice were quantified and determined to be worthless. I recall these periods of my life looking out the windows of Broughton Psychiatric Hospital. That's correct. And the state has deemed me mentally unfit. No more voting or owning a gun for me. At least I'm sure of one of those. I'm sorry, I ramble. I think it's a side effect of the medication I'm on. Anyways, before I became a ward of the state, I was a pretty damn good lawyer. I passed the North Carolina board exam in the 90s and worked for a small law firm for a few years before opening my own office. I married my husband in 2001. I never really wanted children, and I don't think Bill wanted them either. We had a good life, went on vacations, had parties in Lake Norman, and ate at nice restaurants. In the fall of 2021, I was approached by Mr. Ambrose Dillinger, a prominent real estate broker, regarding an estate dispute. A man by the name of Jedediah Reed passed away from COVID the previous year. At the time of his passing, most of the courts weren't open due to the pandemic. This created a time in which the children of his wife's previous marriage decided to claim possession of the family home. Jedediah had a son with his wife, but he was locked up in Butner Prison, serving a sentence of 25 years on a murder charge. I explained to Mr. Dillinger that the property still belonged to the son, unless there was a will that expressly omitted him from the estate. But this didn't seem to discourage him or the wife's children. Mr. Dillinger had big plans to buy the home and the 30 acres it sat on for the purpose of erecting a luxury apartment. A small amount of the money would then be put into an account for the son as proof of sale, essentially creating a paper trail in the event the son protested the theft of the property. The whole idea was a greedy tactic to take advantage of the son's incarceration. I was about to hang up the phone when Mr. Dillinger made me an offer that was too good to be true. If I agreed to bend my moral compass, I would receive more than $3 million in legal fees once the groundwork for the luxury apartment started. Any other time I might have brushed off such an offer, but Bill and I were getting into our retirement age. We weren't poor by any means, but $3 million can buy a lot of happiness in your golden years. Most of my colleagues dream about cases like this. In fact, the first law firm I worked for made its fortune this way. The saying goes, if you're a good lawyer, you can make anything legal. After a few more meetings, I drafted the appropriate documents and filed them with the court. A few visitations between Mr. Dillinger and the son gained us the signatures we needed. The poor sap thought he was getting a life insurance policy payout. He didn't even read the fine print. Within 2 months, the property was bought for a very modest sum from the children, and a small portion was deposited in the son's account. Mr. Dillinger was now the proud owner. One morning, I got a call from Mr. Dillinger asking me to come to the old house. His voice was unsteady and nervous, and he might have even been crying at one point. To this day, I can hear that shattered voice echoing on the phone line.
Please come quick. I can't explain it. I mean, I don't know what it is. I need your help. Just get your ass over here now.
I assured him I would be there, told Nancy, my secretary, I would be out for an extended lunch, and then made my way to my car. The whole drive, my mind played scenarios back and forth. Would I arrive at the house only to be handcuffed by the police? Would a news agent pop out of the bushes with a camera? How would I explain any of this to Bill? After several minutes of driving, I turned down the dirt road leading to Jedediah's house. It wasn't much. A two-story home built in the early 1970s with dirty asbestos siding, gutters filled with leaves, and moss on the roof. Mr. Dillinger's Tesla was parked alongside a white work van in the front. I parked my car next to him, grabbed my Louis Vuitton pocketbook, and exited my car. I walked up the steps that led to the covered porch of the house, pulling the screen door back and knocking on the front door. The silence was interrupted by heavy steps echoing on the wood floor. The front door opened, revealing a disheveled Mr. Dillinger on the inside. His face and designer shirt were wet with sweat. As I stepped inside, he moved to the living room and sat down on an old couch. "What's going on, Ambrose?" I asked, cautious that the police would rush out from the adjacent kitchen. He rubbed his forehead with his right hand, taking a moment to compose himself.
"It ain't the demo crew,"
he responded.
"What?"
I exclaimed.
"Danny and Bob O'Reilly. I have used them on hundreds of jobs. They do excellent work. They usually ensure things like the gas and electricity are off before tearing them down. Sometimes they find stuff, you know, like a nice water heater or a furnace. I don't need that shit, so I let him have it.
Mr. Dillinger said. Confused and growing frustrated, I crossed the living room and knelt to meet his face. What does this have to do with me? Mr. Dillinger seemed almost lost in thought before he responded.
I found a coffin in the basement, but it wasn't empty.
I breathed a sigh of relief. Of course, finding a dead body in a house created some issues, but it wasn't anything to get worked up about. It just meant that we had to contact the police and go through the proper channels. I took Mr. Dillinger's hand and helped him to his feet. A breath of fresh air would probably calm his nerves. We started across the living room towards the door when footsteps came from the kitchen. Mr. Dillinger froze in place, his head turning towards the sound. Perplexed, I pulled his hand, trying to gain his attention, but he wouldn't move. Then, a tall figure appeared in the kitchen doorway. It was a man, or at least it looked like a man. It took a second to register what I was looking at. It had to be maybe 7 feet tall, tall enough to have to stoop under the doorframe. Skin wrapped tight like aged leather. A dirty old suit. The type they bury you in when you don't have a lot of money. The worst part was its eyes. Like black marbles. I've seen eyes like that only once in my life. And that was at the Georgia Aquarium, when the sharks would brush up against the glass. Lifeless, soulless marbles that just know hunger. Dark red gore dripped from its face as it stepped into the living room. I couldn't comprehend what I was seeing. My mind screamed, "Run! Run, you fucking idiot!" But my feet were heavy like cement. The thing took two more steps, now towering over Mr. Dillinger and me. A putrid, sweet smell permeated the room, akin to rotted meat and dead flowers. Then the figure lurched forward, grabbing Mr. Dillinger by his right arm. Whatever spell we were both under suddenly disappeared, replaced by sheer terror. The figure jerked Mr. Dillinger forward, pulling me as well. I had forgotten that I was still holding his hand. Now I was fighting to break free as he was pulled closer to its open mouth. Mr. Dillinger let out a whimper just as the figure snapped down on his neck, sending a jet of bright red blood squirting across the room. The figure took another bite, crunching through bone and tendons. Hot blood gushed down his shirt, spraying me. I pulled hard, this time breaking free of Mr. Dillinger's grasp and falling to the soiled carpet floor. My mind screamed, "Get up! Get up! Get the fuck up!" Legs wobbly, heavy from the fear. More wet, tearing sounds. The figure now through Mr. Dillinger's neck, the head falling to the floor in a heavy thud. "Move. Move. Get to the door." I was crawling, then back on my feet, the front doorknob in my hand. I just had to open it, then push past the screen door. Loud, popping noises coming from behind me, bones being pulled from sockets. I was through the door, the sweet sunlight on my face, the screen door offering no resistance. Then I stumbled, crashing to the porch. my feet inside the threshold of the home. Footsteps followed behind me, wood straining under weight as the figure grew closer. Panic boiling up inside.
Move! Push forward! Get to your feet!
With strength, I pushed myself out of the doorway, collapsing on the porch and looking back inside the home. I froze. The figure standing only inches away, peering down at me. This was it, I thought. At any moment, this thing will cross the threshold and snatch me back into the house. But it just stood there, looking back at me with those soulless black eyes, while chunks of viscera dripped from its leathery face. Then, it did something that shattered my mind. The fucking thing waved at me. Like a parent would wave at a child getting on the school bus. With one crimson-stained hand, it reached forward and pulled the door closed. Later that day, the police would find what remained of Mr. Dillinger and the O'Reilly brothers. The state coroner said it resembled a diving bell accident. No coffin, no 7-foot-tall dead man. The FBI got involved, and before you know it, they unveiled our little scheme. I didn't mind it much at the time. I was too busy suffering from severe PTSD. But Bill, my husband, had a heart attack when they served the warrant for my arrest. Poor bastard dropped dead on the spot. After 2 years and numerous diagnoses, I'm here. I read the local newspaper yesterday. That property was sold to a local bank after Mr. Dillinger's untimely death. They're moving forward with building apartments there, you know? The only problem is they can't seem to keep staff. Workers just keep going missing.
I hope you enjoyed A Dead Man Ate My Real Estate Broker, as written by Shane H. Sellers and performed by Jonathan West. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.